I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source.
I do not believe that any of us would exchange places with any other people or any other generation. The energy, the faith, the devotion which we bring to this endeavor will light our country and all who serve it. And the glow from that fire can truly light the world. And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
In John F. Kennedy's 100th birthday spring, let's look again at the man's oil portrait we all know, sort of. The painter Jamie Wyeth is going to help us read it. His canvas summoned the late president as a ruddy sort of ghost, face aglow in front of deep brown shadows, beefy hand in front of his chin, eyes alert but just out of alignment. One looks into you, one past you. He's returned from another place, mouth open a crack, not quite smiling. I'm seeing bemusement, the mind of an A student hesitating, kindling a wisecrack, maybe hiding something, perhaps pain, injury, illness. He looks not combative exactly, but forceful, open to the fun of teasing or an argument, open to the pleasure of his own company. We're taking fresh impressions this hour of JFK. The painter we begin with, Jamie Wyeth, was the 18-year-old boy wonder in the Wyeth dynasty of artists and illustrators when he undertook his most noted portrait. Jamie Wyeth is 70 now, and he's walking us around the making of an iconic and revealing image.
I'd never done a posthumous portrait. It began, really, the family contacted me, sort of, and I think it was their interest in young people and so forth. But anyway, about doing an official portrait of President Kennedy for the White House. And so I said I would make an attempt. And then after working from photographs and whatnot, I realized that I needed something of life. And so both brothers agreed to let me sort of bird dog them around. At the time, there was campaigns going on, so I went with Teddy around and with Bobby.
When you watched the brothers, Jamie, if I may ask, I mean, what were you looking for?
Well, life. I mean, I just didn't want to work from photographs, and I wanted a living, breathing person. And I'd never met President Kennedy, so I had no memory. So my idea was really to establish a memory of him. And so that I destroyed the first attempt that I'd done, and which was very sort of romantic and this figure striding forward and so forth. And then having worked with the two brothers, I realized, you know, they're remarkable people, but they're very sort of blunt, and their one eye is looking at you and one eye is over your shoulder, and that physical thing where the eye sort of the lazy eye. But anyway, and so I created this portrait, which was alarming to a lot of people, including Bobby, who ended up hating it and said it reminded him of the president during the Bay of Pigs. And
wow. He
obviously had a career ahead of him, and it was useful to him to have this sort of image out there that JFK was this man of strength. And I think this portrait, he felt, shed a light on the sides of his brother that he felt weren't exactly helpful. The one person who really championed it was Jackie and thought it showed a side of the president that few people saw and so forth. And I became completely completely obsessed with painting this thing. And I did it. I shared a studio with my father, and my father would come through the room I was working, and I had drawings everywhere, on the floor and the ceiling. And out of it came this rather peculiar small portrait, which seems to have some resonance today.
Sure it does. I was always struck from the beginning by that meaty hand JFK is sort of leaning into. And it seemed big for JFK, but it's exactly Teddy's hand.
I think it probably is Teddy's hand. But curiously enough, his widow said that was a gesture he did quite a bit. He'd tap his teeth with his knuckles and whatnot. Mm-hmm. Well, that just sent me over the top. You know, I then sort of built the whole thing around that.
There's something of Hamlet's ghost about it. He is alive from another realm, and he's still saying, what was that? And how did it end?
Yeah, I think it shows a man, an enormously complicated man, who I think still just is fascinating. And, you know, it's not the most beautiful portrait of him. It upset a lot of people. And, I mean, I got thousands of letters. I mean, it really was extraordinary.
What was the popular objection.
Why do you have this bloated face? Why do you have one eye looking off to the side, one eye looking at you? Why do you have the hand on the mouth? And again, you have to look in the context at that time. President Kennedy was this young, godlike figure who'd been struck down, taken from us. And here comes this 18-year-old boy painting this rather tough portrait of a man, rather blunt. It was a learning experience for me. I'll never do another posthumous portrait. I mean, I was at a thing that somebody who knew him came in and said, it doesn't look a thing like him. Well, I couldn't, you know, argue that. But, you know, I think the more you look at President Kennedy's career, the more you see a man who wrestled with huge issues and had an amazing sense of history, and particularly compared to what, you know, we're living through today. It's such a departure.
Jamie, there's a piece that I'd love to hear from you, which was Len Billings's contribution. And I read you saying, in effect, that under the portrait of JFK, it's almost a portrait of Len Billings, a man I knew just slightly, but it was well known in the journalistic world that he was Robert Kennedy's maybe closest friend, friend of all the Robert Kennedy kids, and especially of JFK, that he virtually lived in the White House as a member of the family. I mean, really did live in the White House. What did you learn from Len Billings?
That was another incredible eye-opener for me. First, he was unquestionably President Kennedy's closest friend from quite young in his youth to the day he died. And to get to know Lem, who was a terribly sweet man, very funny and whatnot, and of course gay. And I thought this flew in the face of everything that I'd read about President Kennedy, which was all his great affairs and all this, which probably existed. And here was this very real person saying, you know, Jack and I would do this, or he brought me into this. It just gave me a whole different perspective on President Kennedy, and that he would have this man around him more than anybody else. Mm. I mean, he was with him constantly. But the fact that a man who clearly was in love with President Kennedy on many levels, you know, was comfortable with and was close to, I thought was a wonderful insight into John F. Kennedy. I thought it was extraordinary. And I think it was an insight to me that he wasn't threatened by Lamb.
Yes.
That, you know, here was a man who clearly was in love, and then he was comfortable with that. Well, that's fine, you know. And JFK was able to handle that and love it and say, this is part of life.
What part of that, Jamie, is in the painting?
Well, I think it just made him breathe and live and went beyond just me painting a nose and two eyeballs and a shock of hair. It made him of sinew and vessels and bones. It just made him real.
Jamie Wyeth's version of JFK has been reproduced on a postage stamp in Ireland, among many other places. The painting's permanent home is the Museum of Fine Arts, Boston. Frederick Logaval joins us again twice in a week. Fred, welcome back. He is the Pulitzer Prize historian of the French and American wars in Indochina, where President Kennedy played a fateful part. And you're knee-deep now, Fred, in researching a major new biography of President Kennedy. What do you make of that image?
Well, I think that is a wonderful interview that you've had, and I just enjoyed listening to it. I think that, you know, so much in there that one could talk about, including the bit about Lem Billings and the fact that they were together all the time, the degree to which JFK was comfortable with his gay friend. I thought that what he told us about Bobby Kennedy and his view of this image, I think myself that it's a remarkable portrait. There's depth to it. I think it shows a vulnerability.
Mm.
There's also a seriousness, and one of the themes that I'm coming to in this biography is that he's a serious guy, John F. Kennedy. And I think that comes through really powerfully for me.
In the painting, I mean, he's famous for being photographable, which Kennedy was. But to me, that's a story of the artist overleaping the rest of us. Jamie Wyeth then was pretty close to the ambivalences we see in JFK
today. I think he anticipates, yes,
yeah.
Exactly. He anticipates there what I think many of us are now coming to many years later.
I want to know what you are coming to. What's the evidence? And what's the theme of your take, which everybody will be reading, on this man?
Well, he's absolutely, you know, fascinating to me, I hope to readers. I think it's there is such great material. The Kennedy Library down the street is filled with hugely important material.
That we haven't seen?
Well, much of it, I think, has been available, and much of it has been used. A lot of it hasn't been used. I mean, I'm continually struck, Chris, when I'm down there working at what's available. And I'll also highlight that the extraordinary oral history collection, which you don't need to go to the library to use because you can access that. That is an absolute goldmine for me. And I think what I want to show in this book is his extraordinary life, obviously, which is to me is really interesting even before he becomes president. I also want in this book to tell the story of America during this remarkable half century, because he's born in 1917, just as the United States enters World War I. And then he dies in 1963, which in some ways is a kind of zenith of American power. Mm. So here you've got 5 decades, 46 years to be exact. And if I can, as I tell readers about John F. Kennedy and his life and his times, if I can also give a sense of how it is that the United States becomes the greatest power in the history of the world, what it does with that power, and he, let's remember, is president at the apex, right at the end of that period.
I'm struck just recently that he falls exactly at the midpoint of between the anti-imperialist and imperialist fight around this war with Spain in Cuba and in the Philippines and today. Yeah. And he lived this argument. I call it the argument between William James, the realist pragmatist, and his student Teddy Roosevelt, who was all for, you know, he believed life was in war, personal and out there. JFK falls right in the smack of the middle between then and now, and the war went on in his head.
Yeah, no, it did. And I had never quite thought about it in the way that you just said, that he is right at that midpoint. That's a very interesting point. I think that, you know, one of the things that we just heard is that Kennedy has a sense of history. And I think he did grapple precisely with what you just described. And it caused him, I think, grief on occasion. But I think it also made him sensitive to the vicissitudes of history that he was a part of.
Yeah, and he'd fought in the War of All Wars.
Yes.
And suffered it and thought about it and recovered slowly with difficulty from it. And then making enormously important choices. Coming up, from near or far, John Kennedy was unmistakably a man of privilege. Up very close, he was also, and at the same time, a man of sorrows, a man of suffering. This is Open Source. In Boston, we don't forget that John Kennedy was a man of Massachusetts, as he told the state legislature in an eloquent visit between election and inauguration as president.
It was here that my grandparents were born. It is here, I hope, that my grandchildren will be born. What Pericles said of the Athenians has long been true of this commonwealth. We do not imitate, for we are a model to others. And so it is that I carry with me from this state to that high and lonely office to which I now succeed the enduring quality of Massachusetts, the common threads woven by the Pilgrim and the Puritan, the fisherman and the farmer, the Yankee and the immigrant, will not be and could not be forgotten. They are an indelible part of my life.
Martin Nolan covered that state house, as I did, in the 1960s.
He revolutionized American presidential politics, but first Massachusetts politics. He had campaign secretaries in 351 cities and towns in every big ward in Boston, Worcester, Springfield, so forth. So he had a Kennedy campaign. It was not the Democratic Party's campaign.
Right.
And, Chris, he was a true intellectual. He was more intellectual than Adlai Stevenson. That was so unusual. He knew his own stuff. Sure, he had speechwriters, but we forget that he's in the tradition of, before him, Truman, and Lincoln and Jefferson. That's unusual.
Who was he to you, Marty? I mean, in the imagination of young Irish guys growing up in Boston. Did you know him?
I covered him a couple of times before and when he was president, but he was just a, you know, a distant figure. He always had that quizzical smile, like right. He said, "We know this is a gag, guys," which is better than the grim, determined look so many politicians affect, you know. He was very different from Bobby, very different from Teddy. Bobby, as we know, was a hater, as we say, and Teddy was the gregarious Irish cop, as his father called him. But Jack was, as I say, intellectual. He knew what he was doing. He could be tough, but he saw no need to be tough unnecessarily, and he was really different. You know, there was something special about him that was different, certainly from Eisenhower, certainly from Lyndon Johnson, Richard Nixon, Ford, Carter, the lot. Think of the Peace Corps, how many people whose lives that changed both in this country and around the world. That's a big deal. And it wasn't legislation, it was just an idea. Let's get this done somehow.
That was Marty Nolan, late of the Boston Globe. Fred Logavel, are you struck by JFK's Boston beginnings?
Yeah, I mean, what I'm really keen to know, Chris, if how you feel about this. I think you can speak to it better than I can. I would simply say that one of the themes that I want to try to develop in this book is a kind of international JFK, not only mm-hmm. in terms of his foreign policy interests, but even as a young man, his travels, his family experiences. And I think it was a kind of international household in important ways from a very early point. That has something to do with the fact that they're in Boston. It has something to do with the fact that they are a Irish Catholic family. But can I throw it back to you?
Well, you reminded me, among other things, Joe Kennedy told Bobby as a boy, if you get involved in the affairs of Worcester, Massachusetts, you'll never get out of Worcester, Massachusetts. So you're right. It was global from the beginning. Let me say, I covered JFK once in his poetry and power talk at Amherst in honor of Robert Frost. It was a wonderful speech, a wonderful day. He was a marvelous guy to look at, to be near. But later, after his assassination, I learned politics in a strange way from the same people that taught Jack and Bobby in 1946. I went and re-interviewed them at great length in 1963 after the assassination. Wonderful characters like Clem Norton and Patsy Mulkern, these street guys. But what I learned in retrospect, Joe Kane, cousin of Joe Kennedy's, who set up the race in 1946, which meant putting two Joe Russos from the North
That's
End
right. oh,
on
yeah.
the ballot.
Great story.
And somebody from each of the sections, Cambridge, Charlestown, et cetera, of the district, to be sure that nobody was going to rise up again. But the point was simply, what I realize now is JFK, that was not Boston politics. It was Joe Kennedy buying his boy a seat in an perfectly open way. And yet, I love the accent. The accent has never been reproduced, but the presence.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's true. And, you know, there's a new recording in the Harvard archives from 1937 when he is a student at Harvard, a sophomore.
And, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the accent is just so pronounced in that particular recording. It's a great recording.
Speaking of Boston accent, here's another one. In the very hot left lesbian poet Eileen Miles in the TV series Transparent, among others, and she spoofed her own origins in a poem she titled Her American Poem.
A woman I'm currently having an affair with said, "You know, you look like a Kennedy." I felt the blood rising in my cheeks. People have always laughed at my Boston accent, confusing lodge for lodge, party for party. But when this unsuspecting woman evoked for the first time my family name, I knew the jig was up. Yes, I am a Kennedy.
Eileen Miles spoke with us this week about her coming of age in Boston.
I mean, I grew up with Ike, with Eisenhower, who was the bald World War II president. So my perception of presidents was that they were old and they were bald. So the excitement of JFK was that suddenly there was this brown-haired guy who was 40, which was a very kind of curious defining moment around age, because I both thought 40 was old, so why is he so young? But he did look radically different. When I was a kid, I drew a lot, and so in Catholic schools, you know, if you wanted to get a prize in the art fair, you had to draw religious scenes, but you could also draw Kennedy. So
amazing.
I spent a lot of time drawing Jack Kennedy's face and even saw his handwriting, which was really bad and was very moving and exciting to me. And I think I've emulated him in a number of ways. But I think it seemed like 60s. America had a young president, and everybody kept telling us that. And he was a Catholic, which meant that he was on the wall next to the Pope, you know. He was ours.
What did your parents make of him? Mine had questions. He was not quite Catholic enough in a religious sense, and a little high tone, too. They didn't like Joe.
I'm sure they thought Joe was a crook, but I think they dug Jack Kennedy. I think it seemed pretty clear that he was cool. And he was, you know, he was an Irish winner, and I think that's who my family wanted to be. He was, as they said, the High Irish. I had an uncle who lived in Brookline, and there was this lovely private school across the street, and I remember we were told that's where the Kennedys went. And it was like, oh, you know. So they were like the other side of the street, and we liked that side. We wanted to be on that side.
I haven't heard High Irish for a long time, and it's so right.
Right?
High Irish.
Yeah.
How did he evolve in your head growing up?
You know, I have committed the, I was going to say the sin of reading Seymour Hersh's wonderful Dark Side of Camelot,
yeah,
which is an incredible kind of expose of Jack Kennedy and Bobby Kennedy. And I will never see these guys in the same way. It was revelatory. He was privileged, so he believed that he had special sources of information. And I think in some cases he was being played. So history, depending on what history we're talking about, history probably looks at him better than he deserves, you know?
Wow. Do you take him seriously as a mind after all these years, as a searcher?
Kennedy.
Yeah.
What a good question. Well, I don't go to him as an intellectual leader, but I go to him as sort of a physical presence and a person who knew how to mark the spot. Like, we really need people to say we're there now and we need to turn. He knew he stood in history and he was very good at it. You know, and I think he marked America at a certain moment. And, you know, I'm grateful we have a president who's going to do that in a very ugly way right now. And Kennedy did do it in a beautiful way. In retrospect, everything that we thought and felt wasn't necessarily true. It was a moment of hope, you know. I mean, I think people really believed that we were in a new day, you know, and Kennedy was the icon of that day.
Fred Dokeval, she says, historians have treated him too kindly. He had historians all around him and very much a favorite. How do you deal with that?
Well, historians have mixed views on him. Initially, there was a wave of books that were highly sympathetic. And then it seemed like we went too far the other direction. And now there's maybe a sort of a middle ground for many. I'm a bit more critical of the Cy Hersh book than perhaps she is. And I think that, in fact, for me at least, and we all have our own interpretation, we can only go by the evidence as we read it, my assessment of him is more, I think, sympathetic in terms of his place. I think she is so correct in talking about the degree, I think Eileen Miles is so correct in talking about the degree to which he inspired Americans. And I think, and there was hope. She refers, I think, at least indirectly to his wit and to the kind of coolness that he exhibited. And I think those things matter. And the kind of inspiration that he was for a lot of Americans. But I also think there was an intellect there. I think he was a student of history. And I think that's powerful.
Here is a glimpse, fresh this week, of the private JFK. Paul, known as Red Fay from San Francisco, was the president's closest PT pal from wartime in the Pacific. Kennedy made him Undersecretary of the Navy. Sally Fay, his daughter, was a pal of presidential daughter Carolyn Kennedy, especially summertimes at Hyannisport. Sally Fay told me this week about a five-year-old herself finding her hero.
One of the times I remember really well was when we were in Hyannis with the president and Jacqueline and Caroline and John, and I went down to the breakfast table and I was a little bit late. And when I arrived, it was Maria, Courtney Kennedy, and Caroline. And they were sitting across from me. And Maria told a secret to Caroline and then she told it to Courtney. And I asked to be told the secret and she didn't tell me. So I had hurt feelings. So I just excused myself from the table and I went running in to go find mom and dad. And the president happened to be there when I came in with tears rolling down my cheeks. And he was very concerned and asked me what had happened. And I just said, well, you know, Maria told a secret and she didn't want to tell me. And then instantly he called down to Maria and said, Maria Shriver, could you please come up here? And so Maria arrived. And then in front of me, the president said, Maria Shriver, that wasn't a nice thing to do. And if you ever have that kind of behavior in this household again, you won't be invited back.
Wow.
And I know, I was just, oh my gosh, my godfather. And, you know, of course, the president of the United States, I don't know if that was the thing that immediately crossed my mind, but I thought, boy, am I happy that I have a godfather that is this great and that's sticking up for me.
Thank you, Sally Fay. Still in Hyannisport, here's Bobby Shriver this week, son of Sergeant Shriver and JFK's closest sister, Eunice, who gave a lifetime to the Special Olympics for people with handicaps. Bobby Shriver is reflecting on the fighting spirit under the sun on Cape Cod in his own boyhood, which was probably a lot more relaxed than when Jack and Eunice were growing up.
There's the beach, there's the sea, there's the tennis court, and so forth. All of that was competition. We're on. You better get ready to say something smart at dinner. You better figure out, you know, stuff. You better beat the Robert Kennedys at whatever the sport is. You know, that was the whole world. There's a famous phrase in the family, which no doubt you've heard, when somebody says, you know, he's on it. What that meant in the family, and still means to some extent, is you take complete responsibility for the result.
Hmm. There's so many JFKs to remember. What would your mother want us to remember about Brother Jack, the president?
I think that he suffered. Right? What's memorable isn't that he signed the test ban treaty or gave a great speech at American University, or even gave the great inaugural speech. The memorable thing is who he was as a kid and how he survived his suffering. What did he have the last rites administered to him 3 or 4 times?
Maybe 5.
You know, that's tough. The guy had a brutal life, if you ask me. You know, his childhood, that huge family, that level of competitiveness, you know, his injuries in the war, back with the same illnesses, still that level of competitiveness. And that's the human story. That's not the sexy story or the poetic story or the historical story, but the human story is this guy struggled in a hard environment and he made accommodations with himself, with his friends, with his siblings, and he just struggled and did what he did. When I looked at my mom, I could say the same thing about her. Okay, yeah, she founded the Special Olympics, but my mom struggled. She worked like nonstop and never gave up and never went on vacation. Just that's the way we grew up. Just work, 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 work. Tough, 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 tough. Got to get it done. Are you on it? Are you on it? Have you got it? Is it going to be delivered by dinner time? Good. What are you going to do tomorrow?
A lot of stuff to chew on there, Fred Logavall, including the fact that JFK was acquainted with grief, with death. I mean, somebody else said he had a raven on his shoulder all his life. Hmm. Brother Bobby Kennedy said he was in severe pain every day. What does that contribute?
Yeah, I mean, it's really, really true. And I'm thinking through a lot of this, obviously, as I write this book. And, you know, his sister kicks death. And then before that, Joe Jr. and the difficulty that he experienced in terms of personal loss, the difficulties in the Pacific and seeing comrades go down, and then, as you say, his constant battles with health issues. And one of the things that's extraordinary about this is that in his campaigns, beginning in 46, then in 52, to a lesser extent in 58 when he's running for re-election to the Senate, and then in 60, is how incredibly hard he works.
Yes.
He is able to go and from dawn until midnight,
yes,
day after day after day, often with Ted Sorensen, they're flying around the country in a small airplane, and they just go, even though he's got these ailments. So it says something about the family, I guess, and the energy that they have. And I think, you know, Bobby Shriver just spoke to this, but it's extraordinary.
Yeah. My guys who managed him in 1946 always said that. For one thing, they loved him, but they always said, he was always asking, have we done everything we must do? And then he would fold into the Ritz overnight.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Relentless. Come back to these judgments about what makes a great president and the disputed, ranking of his performance.
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt that he benefits from the fact that he was killed in the prime, that he was 46, and that people have, there's a mythology about him that has been built up. But the mythology also exists, I think, because of the degree to which he inspired Americans, and also, by the way, many, many other people around the world. I may have said to you that, you know, in my native Sweden, to this day, people of a certain age, when you mention John F. Kennedy, you know, it's powerful for them. So he had that. And I think in terms of policy decisions as president, it's mixed. I give him high marks by and large for his foreign policy, notwithstanding Bay of Pigs, notwithstanding an expansion of the involvement in Vietnam.
It's a tough learning course, though.
It sure is. It sure is. And it's a very tense time in the Cold War. He's thought a lot about this, however. I think in some ways he comes into the presidency more well-prepared on the foreign policy side than we often think because of the degree to which he's been thinking about foreign affairs, the use of military power for a long time.
I like Marty Nolan's note that, oh, by the way, wasn't legislated, but we're going to do the Peace Corps.
Yeah.
Get busy.
Yeah, and in the first 100 days, by the way. That was one of his 100 days.
Yeah. It's an idea, and it lives, and a lot of people say, you know, it did more for the corpsmen than it did for the folks out there. But even that ventilated the public life of this country ever since. We're talking about John F. Kennedy in the run-up to his 100th birthday. Coming up, sex, sin, ironies, contradictions, and the long view with Richard Reeves and Caitlin Flanagan. And in our studio again, Frederick Logoval. This is Open Source on JFK. In June of his last year on Earth, President Kennedy gave what is often remembered as the speech of his life at American University in Washington, announcing test ban talks with Nikita Khrushchev, and attempting a reconciliation of Russian and American people.
For in the final analysis, our most basic common link is that we all inhabit this small planet. We all breathe the same air. We all cherish our children's futures. And we are all mortal.
20 years after the end of the Kennedy administration, the journalist Richard Reeves reconstructed an almost day-by-day account of it in a 700-page nest of personal stories that historians are still mining. This week, 20-plus years after President Kennedy, the book, I asked Dick Reeves for the nub of it that he would give to his grandchildren.
First place, the presidency is an act of faith. It has to be believed. We have to believe in it, even though we know it's impossible. Nobody is prepared for the job. And in the end, what probably counts is whether the man brought out the best or the worst in the American people. I think Kennedy made mistakes, but he brought out the best in the American people. Long before Tom Brokaw wrote of the greatest generation, Kennedy was the leader of that generation.
I call him the leader of the men's movement known as World War II.
Well, I mean, the symbolism of passing the torch from the overall commander-in-chief, Eisenhower, to a lieutenant junior grade who was 30 years younger really spoke of a lot. I mean, that by itself changed the country.
Yeah. Eisenhower called him, in your book, Little Boy Blue.
Yeah. He was a boy in a bubble, in a way, and was probably too young and had too little life experience to be a great president, although I think he was a very good president.
What's not in your book, Richard, is this sense that in the last year of his life, after the missile crisis, he was in a kind of big existential turn. We got to end this Cold War. We got to get out of Vietnam. We got to talk to Castro. And in the missile crisis, he had confronted a kind of impossible endgame, and he had to find another one. Was he a different man in that last year?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. He was still a young man and thought like a young man, but he grew in the presidency because of the experiences he went through.
But that sense in the American University speech that
Right.
We must reach out to the Russians, recognize their suffering in World War II, treat them as people, get over this communist hang-up. That doesn't come through in the sort of anecdotal Kennedy.
Well, to me, it does come through. I mean, I think that was one of the great speeches in American history, as was his reaction to civil rights when he finally said this is a moral issue.
Yes.
This is not a political issue. So, yes, I think he had grown in many ways. And a large part of that was what amounted to his reluctant partnership with Khrushchev. If good things came out of the Bay of Pigs, and before that, the Berlin Wall, John Kennedy began to understand that Nikita Khrushchev was just another politician, and that they thought alike, they just happened to work in different systems.
Richard Reese, your JFK had not been seen before. He was a very sick man. He was high on Demerol or something like it, what we'd call today opioids. He was in great pain most of the time. He was also, how's to say, addicted to sex, another woman every day. He was a medical wonder, kept alive, really, by pills and shots.
Well, he had the last rites of the church.
He was at the edge of that awareness all his days.
He was in a unique situation, which he hid from most people, that he always expected to die young. And therefore, he had to play by a different set of internal laws than most of us do. He, after all, had a terminal disease. As Bobby once said, if a mosquito bites my brother, the mosquito dies.
You have a wonderful line in your book that irony was as close as he came to having a view of life. He'd like to say, life is unfair.
Yeah.
It was his code, in a way. What does it mean now on his 100th birthday?
That he had a kind of dark view of life. I mean, he thought it was fun.
Indeed.
He was a ruthless man, John Kennedy, and he could be very mean and cruel. He used people without the slightest conscience or empathy for their side of it. On the other hand, going back to the point, he made us proud. He made Americans better. He talked about real ideas, and we were better for it. We trusted him without knowing the darker sides of him, which I think eventually did him in.
Yeah.
But we were a better people for him having been our president. We had faith in ourselves and we had faith in him.
That's Richard Reeves. Fred Loggewell, he really is saying that the health of the people is the test of a president or a great leader.
Yeah, I think there were lots of interesting things that Richard said there. And the line about Kennedy bringing out the best in the American people is one that I heard Richard make actually in California. We were together a couple months ago, and he made that same point in his remarks there. And I think it's very powerful, and I think it's true. I differ a little bit maybe with Richard. I think that empathy, a capacity for empathy, which I think is important in human beings, and it's also important in our leaders, is something that, in fact, Kennedy did possess. So we may differ a little bit there. The outstanding example, I think, is that he showed an empathetic understanding toward Khrushchev at the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis. But I also see it in terms of his day-to-day relations, that he could, partly because of his own suffering, I think he could relate to the difficulties of others. And I think that's one reason he connected with a lot of people during his campaigns and other times as well.
Can I say, so much of the judgment of Kennedy really now turns on this argument that he was a different man in the last year after the missile crisis, that he was a man on fire. I kind of love it, the idea that it brought out historic test. That was where he was quoting Abraham Lincoln in notes to himself, saying, if God has a use for me, I'm ready. What's the evidence?
I think there is evidence for this. I mean, those two speeches, think about this. Two speeches on consecutive days in June of 1963.
Thank you.
The American University speech and then the Civil Rights speech, back to back. And the degree to which he makes civil rights a moral issue, We could say that he was slow to come to that particular point, which I think is true, but he made it a moral issue is very important. The only thing I would say, Chris, is that I think if you go back and look at the inaugural address, which I think is often misinterpreted, if you look at his speech in Seattle in November of 1961, already in other words, already before that last year, we see him making arguments about the Cold War. Mm. Can't we really think through this? Can't we really come to a new understanding with the Soviets even before that last year? So I wouldn't want to suggest that it all flows from the missile crisis and that aftermath. That said, I quite agree with you. There is something in his final year of life that is different from before.
Here is another perspective, Fred Logaball, on another of the several JFKs. The obsessive philanderer with a sex addiction, as Eileen Miles and others put it. The Atlantic Monthly columnist Caitlin Flanagan, in conversation this week, calls herself a progressive voter with conservative social standards. On the matter of John F. Kennedy, she has been a raging contradiction all her life, and not just around his sexual appetite.
You know, he was inaugurated a few days before I was born, so this myth of Kennedy has kind of been with me my whole life, and I feel that I've spent the last 25 years trying to break up with John Kennedy, and I always keep crawling back to him, so I'm kind of hopeless. You know, when I was young, I just thought he was the measure of a man, you know, aside from being so witty in the full range of what that word means, such great wit and such cool, you know, he's just a really cool character, a really cool customer. I really believed that he was really heroic. I believed that he was a great statesman. I believed that he was a champion of these progressive causes. And for me, as an Irish-American, it meant a lot to me that he was Irish. And so all that, he just was the world and all to me. And then I kind of grew up, and you realize that almost everything we believe about him is wrong. You know, starting with the heroism of PT-109, you know, that he saved all these men. But when you really look into it, you know, 14 PT boats went out on that mission. 13 of them came back. Anybody else would have been court-martialed for allowing his men to get killed by having a destroyer ram into your PT boat. And then he, like, supposedly, you know, swims another guy to shore, and there's this whole, like, corny thing where, like, he writes their message out on a coconut like it's Gilligan's Island. It's just nobody would have been decorated for that. PT-109 was a stupendous blunder. And then he supposedly got us out of the Cuban Missile Crisis, but he got us into the Cuban Missile Crisis. LBJ, when he really looked into everything Kennedy had been doing, he said they were running a goddamn murder, Inc. You know, he had all these elaborate plans to assassinate Castro, to unseat his government and everything. And then you get to the thing with women, which on the one hand, you don't want to be guilty of presentism. It was a different time, and certainly in terms of their marriage, you know, to each her own. This was clearly no mystery to Jackie. She certainly knew that he had a lot of other women, but that's not our account. It's just that there was this incredible sleaze factor to it where, you know, Secret Service men have come forward now in the years past talking about how they would have to barricade the doors in hotels when he had these prostitutes in there and what an incredible danger that was just to their role as protecting the president. So a lot of his record, I will say, that's it. No more JFK for me. And Kennedy had a magic to him. The force of his personality was so great. And the force of the ideas that he stood for, if not that he worked on behalf of, were just mesmerizing. So whenever somebody like really hates JFK, I understand why. And whenever somebody loves JFK, I understand why. I love him. Every time I'm in Boston, which is not infrequently, I go to his library. I cry like a baby walking through the exhibit downstairs. I'm sunk. I'm lost. I'm like the abused wife of JFK in my dreams. So I'm hopeless. He's great. I love him. But he's just a terrible president.
Fred Logaball, you've probably heard that before. Quick reaction.
Well, so it's just, I love listening to her, and also her piece in The Atlantic, which I want to say is maybe 3-4 years ago, is really illuminating. I think that, you know, I don't agree with her on PT-109. I don't agree with her on the Cuban Missile Crisis. I think she's quite right that he helped make the crisis happen in the first place. It's an important point. But I think if you listen to the tapes and you look at the evidence, we should all be grateful, as many people have said, that it was John F. Kennedy who was president at that time. I think on the womanizing and on sex, I think she's very astute, including in the article. You know, the truth is that sex was incredibly important to him, and I don't think he was going to let anything stand in his way on that issue. And the result was recklessness, both before and after he became president, And not to mention the fact that it was hurtful to Jackie, even if she knew what was going on some level, accepted it, maybe even expected it, given her own father's
dalliances. Not to mention JFK's father,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and of course, and JFK's.
Time running out. Let me ask, or just to say, for many of us, far the most remarkable thing about John Kennedy is that we don't know who killed him. And before that, what he was doing in the world. Was he stuck in a Vietnam War that he knew deep down was folly? Or was he, as we want to believe, well along toward ending the Cold War with a tough new discipline of peace?
I mean, I think on foreign policy, the counterfactual, as we call it, what would have happened if Kennedy had lived? I think it matters. And I'm one of these people in my classes at Harvard, I preach the importance, unlike many historians, of doing counterfactual analysis, considering unrealized alternatives in history, because I think they can help us better understand what did happen in history. I think he was committed to a new Cold War and I think wanted to end the Cold War with the Soviet Union when he died. I think if he survives, though we can never know, the best argument to me is that he avoids, and I write about this in a forthcoming article, essay, The best argument is that he avoids a large-scale war in Vietnam of the type that Johnson embarked upon. And I say that even though I fault John F. Kennedy for expanding U.S. involvement in Southeast Asia during his presidency. He made things more difficult for Lyndon Johnson than they would have been otherwise. I still think, however, it's very hard for me to imagine, given his steadfast opposition to committing ground troops.
Right.
It's hard for me to imagine that he makes it a large war of the type that Johnson did.
I'm just being reminded that reading about this for this program, that he was adamant about no ground troops.
Oh, yes.
Advisors, we'll call them advisors, but be no Marine landing at Da Nang.
And let's be honest, you know, some of the advisors were taking part in combat. So, you know, there's a fuzzy line there, but nevertheless, there's a difference between that and committing regular ground forces.
Big difference. And yeah. I mean, he was, till the end, quoting MacArthur about no land wars in Asia. Furthermore, he never said, we're going to win this war. We're going to be steadfast. We're not going to be chased out. We're going to be constant or something. But he did not say, this is a war we've got to win. And that, too, is a kind of, reads now like a very considered restraint.
Yeah, and let's bear in mind as well that I think he would have come to the critical point in Vietnam in early 1965, about the time that Johnson did. In early 1965, let's assume he's reelected, I think he would have been, he can't run for reelection. So he's in his second and final term. I think that makes a big difference because for Johnson, it was effectively his first term. And I think a big reason why Johnson escalated was because of his concerns about reelection in 68.
Got to ask you in a hurry. You know, President Trump will have a decision as to whether the archives, all the archives of the CIA and other agencies will be opened on the 100th anniversary of John Kennedy's birth. It would certainly be a way to upstage the questions about James Comey, but will he do it? Should he do it? Can you imagine what's in there? It strikes me, as I say, the mystery is why we don't know more.
Yeah. I mean, my own view is, for now, that this was Lee Harvey Oswald who committed the murder.
I don't believe it.
But
go ahead.
And we'll differ. My guess is that Trump will do it. I am of the view, and maybe I'll be completely wrong, Chris, about this. I'm of the view that the documents may not tell us as much as we think about what occurred. You ask whether he should do it. My guess is that any president, this is not a question or an issue about Trump, I think any president at this point probably should release all of those documents. If there's something that is of especially private nature, I could see excising that, but I think they should be released.
I think my guess would be just the opposite, that when we know more about what the CIA did in those days, including to Lumumba in the Congo, who was killed before President Kennedy knew it. He came into office saying, first thing, let's get Lumumba out of house arrest. And somebody had to say, Mr. President, Lumumba is dead. The more we know about CIA rogue agents, meant to be rogue agents, that were circulating around the president before and after Dallas, I think we're going to find a whole another story if it hasn't been destroyed already. Who's to say?
You may be right. We shall have to wait and see.
Thank you, Frederick Logoval.
It's a pleasure.
And Caitlin Flanagan, and Richard Rees, and Jamie Wyeth. Thanks also to our Kennedy loved ones, Bobby Shriver and Sally Fay, and our fellow Bostonians, Eileen Miles and Marty Nolan. Our show is produced by Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, Frank Horton, and Becca DiGregorio. Susan Coyne does our spectacular illustrations. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our commander-in-chief. I'm Christopher Lydon, happy to serve on Open Source. Join us next time.